now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come for America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
You know, it's not often that I read a novel that sends me to Wikipedia to look up the historical events that are referenced in the plot line, but this one did it. This one is really cool, and I think you're going to enjoy it. And it's coming from somebody you're familiar with. He's been a regular guest on this program, and he's got a new series just launched that we'll be talking about. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert, our guest, author of the Chronicles of the Nephilim series, a number of other books, and the new series, Chronicles of the Watchers, the first book, The Dragon King, First Emperor of China. Welcome back to Brian Godawa. Brian, you set this in the intertestamental period between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and you took it outside the Bible lands. You basically starting something. What prompted you to basically jump not only into a new time, but a new place with this new series?
Yeah, well, it's kind of twofold. One is, I'm following the same Watcher paradigm that I used in Chronicles of the Nephilim. And what I mean by that is, if we go back to the Old Testament and the ancient Near Eastern notion that behind the earthly powers on earth of kingdoms of men, particularly, there are spiritual powers behind them. This is what the Apostle Paul writes about when he says principalities and powers that we fight against. The understanding was, and in Deuteronomy 32, that's where we first read about this notion that after the Tower of Babel, it says that God dispersed the nations on the earth. Mm-hmm. And when he did so, because mankind was so rebellious, he placed all the Gentile nations, right? The 70 nations of Genesis 10, all of them under the authority of the sons of God. And what does that mean? And the basic notion there is that these sons of God are the divine heavenly beings. And I believe that the context in that passage, as well as the rest of the Bible, is that those particular sons of God are fallen. And so there's 70 over the main nations of that time era. And so it's this notion that there are territorial spirits, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But I think of it more in terms of behind earthly powers, there are heavenly powers. And this is where the notion of spiritual warfare comes from.
Right.
And so this is something that goes throughout the Bible. And of course, it's in Chronicles of the Nephilim. And I wanted to sort of take that paradigm and apply it. Well, if there are these beings who are in authority, certainly they won't be just in biblical stories. They could be in other stories of other nations. And, you know, we get a hint of this in Daniel, where it talks about how the prince of Persia, and that word for prince is an indication of spiritual power. The prince of Persia and the prince of Greece were fighting against the prince of Israel, who was Michael, right? And so prince of Persia, prince of Greece, you know, there's spiritual warfare going on in the heavenlies with these other authorities, right? So this is kind of what I call the Watcher paradigm. And, I always want to give credit where it's due. I was initially discovered this in the Bible through the writings of Michael Heiser. And of course, his big book right now is The Unseen Realm. And I highly recommend it to everyone. It's a good, strong theological addressing of this, this and other issues, including the Nephilim and such. So I wanted to do that. And then the second element is my buddy, Charlie Wen. We go to church together, and we've been talking about possibly working on something together. Now, Charlie was the past visual director of Marvel Studios.
Yeah.
What's that?
I looked him up on IMDb. He's done
our connection is real bad. You're really jumpy, just so you know. It's hard for me to hear you, but go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. I'm looking at the connection here. Yeah. All right. Well, that's the downside of living in the Ozarks here. Our satellite internet connection is wonky, and we're connecting right now through my cell phone.
Actually,
we might want to turn off the video and just go with audio here. That might improve the connection a bit.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Have I been a good, oh, an okay connection, or should we redo it?
No, no, yours has been fine. Okay. So the audience doesn't need to hear, you know, they, you know, what you hear on your end, the audience doesn't hear. As long as it's coming through fine on this end, we're good. So no trouble there. But anyway, I looked up Charlie, and his IMDb credits are pretty spectacular. He's done, what, like the last 8 Marvel films in terms of the visual design, including Age of Ultron and Thor the Dark Realm and what was the most recent one? Oh, Ant-Man.
Yeah, this guy is fantastic. And, I mean, if you want to see some of his artwork, he did a couple pictures for the Dragon King that are on the website. So you could go to Godawa.com and go to books and find the Dragon King website under Godawa.com. And you can find a couple of drawings he did for it. The guy's phenomenal. He worked literally on developing the visual look for all those movies. You know, and that includes like working on what the uniforms and all that would look like on the characters. So yeah, he's way beyond me in terms of, you know, actual real world success. But here's the interesting thing is, you know, he's actually gone out on his own now because he has been sort of, for years, he's done, basically he said for years he's worked on developing other people's ideas. And he has a bunch of passionate ideas of his own that he wants to develop. And intellectual properties and everything from, you know, movie ideas to video games and all that kind of stuff. And one of the ideas that he had was something that he'd been stewing on for a long time. And it was, he wanted to tell the story of the first emperor of China. And the reason why he did was very fascinating. He said that a couple things. One is he said that right around this time when the first emperor of China, whose name is Qin Shi Huangdi, and I think people might actually be more familiar with him than they realize, he's the guy who is famous for all those terracotta soldiers, you know, that you see in China that were buried right in the ground, and they've since unearthed them, and he has this big sort of pyramid-type tomb that is very famous. And he's also famous for, he didn't start the Great Wall of China, but he completed it. It had been started in little bits and pieces, and he actually built the whole thing and connected. Like, there were pieces of wall here and there, but he made one big wall. So he's famous for that, as well as famous for unifying China as it had never been done before. And what that means is, he unified the language for the first time, unifying the culture, unified weights and measures. And this is very, very obviously a very influential thing. But there's also a dark side to it. And that was that, you know, Charlie said that around this time, you know, maybe not exactly, but around this time was when the dragon became a more ubiquitous positive symbol for the Chinese, including emperors. Now, the dragon had been used before, but what happened at that time was the religion, he also sort of like around his time period was when the more animistic, polytheistic kind of religion took over. Because in the ancient Chinese past, the Chinese people actually worshipped a single god. And this isn't entirely unique, but in that time period, only the Jews pretty much did. Mm-hmm. And something else about that god was that they had no images, which at that time was a very, in history, only the Jews had no images of God. So there's this connection that Chinese Christian writers are trying to communicate to their own people even about how their ancient past is not a Western religion. Like, you know, like people say, oh, Christianity is a Western religion. I'm like, no, look, in our deep past, we worshiped a single God without images who's actually what, and they claim that they came from the Tower of Babel, right? When the nations were spread upon the earth.
Right, right.
So Charlie was telling me about this, and I just, my jaw dropped, not because I didn't know it, but because I did. I had actually read books about this stuff a little bit, and I was familiar with it. And so I was already fascinated and like, yeah. And not only that, but I told him about some material that I knew that he was familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I read some material where, again, the Chinese Christians are sort of making this point. And that is that if you know anything about the Chinese language, you know, it's a pictorial type language, and it's changed over the years. And in the ancient times, it was more pictorial than it is now, of course. So it was pictograms and sort of ideograms and phonetics all mixed in together. But basically, it was pictographic, mm-hmm. which means their words were very visual oriented. So a lot of their words were literally looked like the things they were writing about, right? So if you look into the history of their language, you'll find that there is some of their ancient words actually reflect theology from the book of Genesis mm-hmm. that they could not have gotten from the Bible, because it was long before the Bible was written and long before they even came in contact with the West and heard about the Bible. You know, we're talking thousands of years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for example, the word for boat, this is the classic one, the word for boat or ship is a little boat with eight mouths or eight people in it.
Right, which would be Noah.
Eight? Noah and his family.
Exactly.
And, you know, if you look at other ancient myths, they don't have eight people. They'll have, like, the Greek myth has two and, you know, this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, and not only that, but the word for tower actually is very reminiscent of the Tower of Babel. And it has this idea about, connected to it, about all being unified and being separated and all this kind of stuff. I'm not a linguistic expert, so, you know, you have to get the book to read. But and then other words like tempter is like two trees in a garden, you know, with mm-hmm, a mouth mm-hmm. whispering to a woman or something like that. And so their language, you know, this is another tie back to the God of the Bible that truly fascinated me. And I told him about that, and he knew a little bit about that. And so we basically said, you know what, we got to tell this story together. And we decided we wanted to show the spiritual truth to it. And we also wanted to tell the story kind of like the Asian stories, Asian movies are often nowadays. You might watch a Asian battle movie or, I don't know, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon or whatever. And there's a heightened sense of reality. Even the ones that are more realistic are not afraid to sort of, you know, heighten the reality. Maybe have a dragon in it or maybe have some sort of supernatural abilities that people can do, you know. So we wanted to add a little bit of that in order to communicate the spiritual reality that's going on, right? Mm. And so what we came up with was this notion that we developed the story together. And I ended up writing it for the novel, which is called The Dragon King. And but one of the things that we realized was, you know, we wanted this to be an East meets West type of thing. We wanted something that both Eastern culture and Western cultures would like. And I think we both come from the Hollywood industry. So at first we were thinking about making a movie, writing a script and stuff. And then we realized that, you know, even if we do that, we want to have a property that really has our message in it.
Mm-hmm.
And something that we can control. So we thought, we'll write the novel first, you know, and then maybe in the future, if it gets some attention, you know, we could go towards a movie. But we still think like movie guys, right? So we're thinking, okay, he's like, I don't want this to be offensive to the Chinese, you know, audience. And I'm like, I don't want this to be offensive to the American audience. Why? Because, you know, a lot of times you watch these Hollywood movies nowadays and it's very vogue, very fashionable.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you have a contrast of Eastern and Western cultures, it's basically, wow, look at how wise the East is. We have to learn something from them because we're kind of ignorant, you know, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
It's very anti-Western, anti-American. And I'm like, I don't want that. But I want to show the clash of cultures and show where there's good and bad in both sides. Because there is a higher kingdom than the East and the West that brings meaning to all, you see. And that's kind of – we both agreed on that. And that was the sort of the impetus that got us going. So what we came up with was at that time period, which was around 220 BC when the first emperor of China was, over in the West what was going on was the Seleucid Greek Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, right after Alexander had defeated the world and died, his kingdom was sort of bickered over by his four major generals, and it kind of split up the Ptolemies and the Seleucids and mm-hmm. some other guys. And the Seleucids kind of controlled Mesopotamia and the Levant, Canaan and Israel and all that. And they were growing. And so this was the time period of Antiochus the Great.
Right, right.
And he was a really fascinating king himself. But so we wanted to take someone from the Greek world and come up with a story that would be, you know, look, it's going to be a fictional story, but we wanted to sort of tell it in the context of a true context of what was going on at the time. And at that time, Babylon, the city of Babylon, was in ruins, so to speak. I mean, it wasn't completely ruins, but I mean, it wasn't big anymore. You know, it wasn't a powerful city or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It was more like a residue. And yeah, but they still had Babylonian magi there, right?
Right.
And the magi were actually, if you remember back in Daniel, the magi were actually affected and trained by Daniel several hundred years earlier. So right. If you can see the connection that's starting to happen, that's what happened to us when we started. We actually didn't start out trying to make it what it ended up becoming. As we did the research, we found these fascinating connections with biblical notions that we thought, you know, this is really powerful.
Yeah.
Let's really put this all together. And so we came up with the basic storyline, which is the Greek kingdom in Babylon, Mesopotamia, is crumbling because it's overextended. And so the Greek king sends his disgraced general to go to the land of the Far East because he wants him to bring back an omnipotent weapon that he heard is over there. It's a dragon, right?
Yeah,
he's heard that dragons give you power. So bring me back a dragon so I can consolidate my power. So that's sort of the journey that we began. And that's how we get our Greek hero over into the Orient. And that's how we get the different cultural clash of cultures that begins with the story.
And it was fascinating to me because I'm kind of a history nerd anyway, certainly not a scholar, but I always find it interesting how just a single person at a single point in time can be put in a situation that a single decision can influence entire cultures for generations, for millennia, you know. And so that was why I kept going back to Wikipedia, because the disgraced general, the character that you chose, is an actual historic person who really did lose in a spectacular fashion the battle at which he is disgraced in your novel. The activities of the first emperor of China are, as you mentioned, are historic. But of course, most of us, when we read the history books, aren't given the same rationale for his actions, and the same with Antiochus, which, by the way, is really timely considering the popularity the last 5-6 years of George R. R. Martin's Game of Thrones, you know, Song of Fire and Ice, and the queen who's raising up these dragons as her weapons of mass destruction. So so it's very timely in that regard. But there were things, you know, I spent as much time digging into and then following. I can get lost for entire days in Wikipedia. And I know that Wikipedia, you have to be, you know, take a lot of those entries with a grain of salt, especially any entries that relate to social issues. But
yeah. So social, moral, or political issues, forget it. But you're right. I check it out for history too. It's a great primer. In fact, I used it to get a lot of details for the characters as I was writing them.
Yeah, and it's a good source, as you say, a primer, as a way to get started down the path. And finding the links between that character and Antiochus and the battle that was fought at Babylon in about 221 BC that led to the defeat of this particular general, the battles and struggles of the first emperor of China, his obsession with finding the fountain of youth, the secret of immortality.
Yeah.
Which is historic.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, people will read this, and it's one of those things where, like, the true story, you know, you just go, like, this was made for a movie type of thing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're reading this, you're going to be thinking, wow, that's really clever, Brian, that you made that up. But I'm like, I fictionalized some things, but even the very climactic ending when there's, like, this, you know, ships and a sea monster, let me just say that, it's a little fantasy, obviously, that I add to it, but it's still based on what really happened, you know, and what they claimed happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we were so excited to be able to have our creative license, our creativity, our fantasy element that we added, to have it still based spiritually on what really happened, and that's a that's an exciting thing. And a lot of it's discovery. But if your listeners want to find out more about this, YouTube has a couple of, go to YouTube and type in like the First Emperor of China documentary or something like that. There's a couple of great documentaries that have been made with little, and they sometimes do some, dramatizations that are really good. And they can get that, the spiel of what happened, because this guy, he was looking for the elixir of immortality.
Mm-hmm.
And he believed he was a god, but he wanted to live forever and all this. And he literally did almost bankrupt his empire in that search for it. And the whole premise of how he comes in contact with the Babylonian Magi is actually based on what he did. He sent people out. He sent people out to go find other alchemists, all around that he could to try to work on this, to try to create the elixir for himself. And in the meantime, he's building this huge monument to himself that, incidentally, is pretty much like a ziggurat, which is the same temple design all around the world through all ages, right? How'd that come? Where'd that come from, right? Maybe there's a spiritual origin to this,
Exactly. Everything from Mexico to Bosnia, they've got these step pyramid type things that just keep Bosnia. No.
Yeah, Bosnia. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Yeah, for a second, I'm thinking, wait, no, I meant Bulgaria. No, Bosnia is correct. They just recently discovered. But you're right. Yeah. The same basic design, the whole step pyramid thing, the ziggurat design. You're right. Where did that come from?
And what does it mean? And of course, readers of Chronicles of the Nephilim will know that ziggurats are actually spiritual holy temples. They believe that they were literally stairways to heaven. That's why they're step pyramids. And they believe that they were holy mountains. In other words, in the ancient world, they basically believe that mountains were where you went to meet the gods. And of course, the Bible's no stranger to this either. It's the same thing with God and Mount Sinai, right?
Exactly.
You meet gods on mountains. And so that's why mountains are considered holy. And so what they would do is they would bring the mountain to their city, so to speak, and they would build their holy mountain so that the god, they would have connection or access to the gods within their city. And this is what the book of Genesis means when it talks about at the Tower of Babel, they were building a tower to the heavens. It's not this silly notion that, they were trying to build a tower so high it would reach the heavens. No, that's not at all. It simply was the tool or the mechanism by which they made contact with the deities. So, at the top of the ziggurat would be a temple, and that's where they would meet with the gods, right? And so this is the notion that's all worldwide, and you find it back in Babel. And so I bring that also into the story, and like I said, without revealing too much, I do bring the Watchers notion into it as well. And also this notion of dragons and what the Western mind thinks of a dragon versus what the Eastern version of the dragon is very different and will surprise some readers as they get into the story.
No, it was really fascinating. And of course, I picked up very quickly on the very familiar names of the Magi who accompany the Greek general.
And,
yeah. So I'm looking forward to seeing. No, I'm not going to reveal anything. Just say that people who are paying attention will recognize them.
Yes, everything has meaning in this story. Everything has some kind of a connection.
Yeah. No, the pieces of this puzzle fit together really, really nicely. And again, as kind of a history nerd anyway, this was really fun reading through it and kind of peeling back the layers. And even looking at the people who lived north of the Long Wall that the first emperor was building, the Xiongnu people, which again is echoed in George R.R. Martin's work, the wildlings that live north of the ice wall. It's that same kind of thing. But they really had this empire north of the wall that forced the emperor to build this thing to keep them out. Which is fascinating. Let's detail a little more some of the parallels between what the ancient Chinese worshipped and that one god that they worshipped and what we know as the biblical god, Yahweh. What were some of the other parallels, the characteristics of this ancient deity that modern-day Christian Chinese are trying to relay to their people as they witness.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because there was also, okay, in the ancient, before the time of the first emperor, in the time of the feudal world, warring states and such, the various various leaders of the areas would have their own little temple. And even in the oldest days, once a year, the king of the area would go and engage in what they call the border sacrifice. And that was kind of like the Day of Atonement for the people type of thing. And you know, they would do the typical sacrifice of goats and lambs or whatever. But this was the notion. And some of these these altars still exist in China. And, you know, they've been adapted. Like, I think the famous one is the Temple of Heaven, which is in Beijing, I think. And that is one of the biggest. It's like a couple miles square, right? And it's been adapted, but that had been there from ancient times.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea was that once a year they kind of did that Day of Atonement for the people on behalf of the people, and only the emperor could do it, kind of like the high priest.
Yeah.
And like I mentioned, there was no images of Shangdi is the word that they used for the single god, Shangdi. And it's interesting because I've read some old 1800s books written by missionaries or Western sort of, what do they call them again? With the guys in the 1800s that loved going and discovering the other cultures, you know? Anyway, they wrote some books on it, and fascinating to discover the sort of the spiritual, you know, view that they had, which is not too different from what you and I and those of our ilk who have studied the Nephilim and the Watchers,
mm-hmm,
and the Divine Council. They had very much of a similar notion of the Divine Council. And the Divine Council is the notion, it's in the Bible, it's, you know, Psalm 82 and 85, where it talks about God takes his seat amongst the gods.
Right.
And these lesser gods, you know, Christians are very, very afraid to face this truth in the Bible because they're worried about their own cultural prejudices of monotheism. But the fact is the Bible does speak about gods with a reality, a spiritual reality, and we have to deal with this reality, and we have to understand within a biblical context. And the biblical context, in my opinion, is the Divine Council, which is the notion that the holy ones, or the sons of God, those without number that surround the throne of God. God's throne is not just a throne, but it's actually a legal courtroom as well. And we see this as well in the book of Revelation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Divine Council are those beings that surround him, you know, and we've got cherubim and seraphim who are like holding up his throne and above him with the wings and all this stuff. But then the Divine Council, and it shows up in several passages like the book of Job, where it talks about how the sons of God come together to deliberate, and that's Satan was part, actually, the Satan, the adversary, was, mm-hmm, part of that legal, it's like a legal structure. So that even in the book of, I think it's Micah, right, where, I think it's Micah 3, if I'm remembering correctly, sorry if I'm wrong, but it's one of those, or Zephaniah 3, one of those, I'll look it up maybe while we're talking, but where it talks about how the high priest comes before God's throne and Satan comes before God's throne, and he accuses the Joshua, the high priest. And it's this legal courtroom scenario that's going on in the prophet. And he talks about this, and that's the Divine Council there is there with God. So in other words, it's a picture of God has a heavenly council with whom he does deliberate legal matters on earth. It's legal spiritual matters. Mm-hmm. Matters. And some of these divine council, sons of God, you know, they fell to earth. And this is where we, you know, hear about in the book of Genesis, the sons of God with the daughters of men and all that. And the book of Enoch explains it more in more in depth. But the idea is that some of those fallen came to earth and they're rebellious. And so they're still around, and they still are over these anti-God nations, right? And so this is like the picture of the scenario of the Divine Council. And the, going back to the original question then, so the Chinese had a very similar notion where there was Shangdi, and there were they did have these notion of these other gods, these other deities, but they were all in subjection under the authority of the one true God. And you could not have images of him. So these were just the few things, the few elements that I discovered. Beyond that, there's not a lot that we can learn about the really ancient Chinese, but there's some more details about him. But those similarities were enough to tell me that what the Chinese Christians are saying might have some powerful truth to it, namely that, yeah, the people that came to China after the Tower of Babel, when things spread out upon the earth, they may have, because they were cut off from everyone else, they may have retained a little bit more of the true God. It got corrupted. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's totally everything was acceptable to God. I'm just saying it was less corrupted, their understanding of God in China, than it got in the West. And so, but then over time, even they too got totally, Shangdi got corrupted out of the process, and they became more animistic, more polytheistic, or whatever you want to describe, where the focus became on the ancestors and the ancestors' deities and all this kind of stuff. And Shangdi, the one god, kind of went out. And like I said, this happens around that time period of the first emperor. And you know, as a Christian, you know, when we hear dragon, what do we think, right?
Well, yeah, with the evil one, the one that's going to show up again.
Yeah, the serpent and the dragon, the evil one, and, you know, Revelation, you know, the dragon comes to. So I thought, you know what? What if there's some true spiritual connection there, that this obsession with the dragon does reflect a satanic control of that territory to some degree? And so that's kind of one of the elements that we bring into the story. And, you know, there's a whole nother thing that happened in the course of our research and developing the story. That's kind of the heart of what we were pursuing, right? But we didn't realize that we would discover a much deeper connection through the Magi and stuff, but another deeper connection that's sort of reminiscent of Raiders of the Lost Ark, if I can say, and a much deeper connection, again, through legends and stuff like that, not necessarily hard facts, but it was a connection that gave the whole thing spiritual meaning with sense. Now, I don't want to spoil it for the listeners. But,
and neither do I, because it's really cool.
And all I can say is we didn't set out to discover that. We discovered it with the story. So when you discover it in the course of the story, don't think that it was made up, because it wasn't completely made out of cloth, you know, how it connected everything together. You know, the only hint I'll say is that, yeah, it's kind of connected to the Bible, the Hebrew Bible and the Jews. And so that's the spiritual connection we wanted to sort of to make. We discovered it ourselves as well.
Really well done. And like I said, the way you blended together, you and Charlie were able to take the pieces of history and fit them together with, you know, enough fiction to tell a really good, exciting tale is quite an accomplishment. And as I said before, this book I read through in 2 days, and lately, in the last few years, I really don't have time to sit down and read as much fiction as I would like. I used to be, you know, I was one of those guys in high school who was always hiding a book behind my notebook so the teachers wouldn't see me reading science fiction novels in class. and you know, I would be that guy if I had the time, but this one drew me in and held me for a couple of nights, and I got all the way through it. It's a good read. The characters you care about, and again, the historical detail combined with enough fiction and undergirded with that Watcher's paradigm, that divine counsel worldview, is really a lot of fun. It's something that you can recommend for young adult readers as well, because it's not, you know, there's some action involved in it, but this isn't like George R.R. Martin. Hate to keep bringing him into the conversation, but, you know, Game of Thrones, the thing that finally turned me off of Song of Fire and Ice after the third novel was, you know, there's no moral compass here. The only moral compass is, you know, do unto others and do it before they can do it to you. You know, it's
power.
Exactly.
That's really sad, because honestly, as a writer myself, as a storyteller myself, one of my major sort of worldview things that I think is a part of my calling of my of the stories I tell is I do believe that there is an ultimate battle. You know, everyone can say the ultimate battle is between good and evil. Yeah, but what defines good and evil is what's important. And
right.
And to me, I do think it really does come down to power or goodness. And of course, goodness as defined by God. Mm-hmm. And so I understand and I incorporate this notion that people in the world ultimately either just believe in power and which is the ultimate God of this world and therefore they're under the power of Satan, right? Or they believe in God and they seek righteousness or goodness or whatever, you know. And so I deal with that issue a lot, but you don't have to be nihilistic. You don't have to be mm-hmm. extreme, you know. And I think that's the problem is that Martin himself, his own worldview, he doesn't have an ultimate value or meaning or purpose in life. So he's not going to write about it because he doesn't know what it means to
exactly,
have it.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why I've recommended for people who enjoy that type of story, a novel by a writer named Vox Day called Throne of Bones, which is similar, but he's writing it from a Christian perspective. And he also includes some of the Watcher paradigm in his story. Yeah. Imagine what you'd get if you took like the late Roman Republic, just before the Roman Empire, and you added to that the power of the medieval Roman Catholic Church, okay, as an entity and its political influence, and then set it in Rome, but then the lands occupied by the barbarians, you know, the Germanic tribes back in the day, were occupied instead by elves and dwarves and orcs and trolls.
Oh, okay.
And that's what you get with Throne of Bones. But he also, but again, he's writing from a Christian perspective, so you do have a moral compass in it. And that makes all the difference.
It's unsatisfying. The nihilism of Game of Thrones, I'm sorry, it's unsatisfying.
Mm-hmm.
It just really is. I mean, because when it comes down to it is when you're watching that stuff, you know, in your heart of hearts, and when you're reading it, you're like, you know that this isn't all there is. And because if this was all there is, then there's no meaning, there's no purpose, even in the story itself. And so I try to write from the perspective that takes into account the real evil that's in this world, though. Because on the other spectrum, you know, you have the Christian happy talk,
right?
Religious happy talk or spiritual happy talk where, you know, I don't even want to go into the Christian movies. That's my business that I come from. And I am just so completely, continually disgusted with how completely fallacious so many of the standards of Christian movie makers are. They're in their unwillingness to depict evil, basically, and just show the victory of God or whatever, the victory of Jesus. And they're completely creating an opposite false picture of the nihilism. It's a positive nihilism. Yeah. I don't know what you'd call it, but.
And when evil is often depicted as almost so evil that it's cartoonish, that it's so over the top evil that, it, you know, it's okay. Yeah. We can spot this evil. The real evil that we often encounter in the world is the evil that looks really good, appealing,
yes.
Attractive.
Yes, and that's you're right. That's another good side that I try to bring up in Dragon King, and most of my stories is I try to make it look enticing. It's not just like, hey, come join. It's not join the dark side, because it's like nobody believes they're joining the dark side. They all justify what they're doing, right?
Right. Right.
And so, a good villain is going to be someone who really does have a convoluted, ultimately, but on the surface, a reasonable justification for why he's doing what he's doing, and all evil people actually believe what they're doing is good, so they have a rationalization for it.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's the ability to depict that in a realistic way that people can say, yeah, I've seen people like that, or, you know, there are people like that in the world. That's the best villain rather than the, you know, whatever, the Snidely Whiplash or whatever you want
right,
to call
right.
it. You know, but here's the thing, though. What I was trying to get to was with the storyline and stuff. Oh, and you know, like I deal with some of these Christian movies, and I know people who are in the inside editing them and making them, and it's just so sad to me because on their side they'll cut out smoking a cigarette. Oh, we don't want to show smoking a cigarette.
Right.
It's like, what? the person at the, that point in their life, they're not honoring God anyway. And so what's the big, you know, if you don't show it, you're not accurately showing their sinfulness or whatever. It's like, well, no, showing that will encourage it. Or, you know, they have these ludicrous, ludicrous understandings of how to accurately depict man's sinfulness. And they don't want to is the problem. Mm-hmm. They want to somehow communicate man's bad, but they're afraid, in particularly in Christian movies, they're afraid to actually show that badness in a realistic way. Mm-hmm. So at most they'll hint at it or whatever, you know, because they're, it's just, it's very, very sad to me. And why I'm saying that is because my novels, Chronicles of the Nephilim, for those who've read it know that, you know, they're probably PG-13, sometimes on R rated material, because I do show that reality, that evil
depravity,
The depravity that's similar to Game of Thrones, though not as bad.
Right.
But in The Dragon King, it's a different kind of story because it's really more like a PG movie, a PG action adventure fantasy movie. And that's the, we just approached it from that angle this time. So it's more like, you know, a little harder version of Raiders of the Lost Ark type of thing. You know what I'm saying? So we've got romance, we've got love, we've got bad guys and serious issues, but I'm not as explicit as I was in Chronicles of the Nephilim, and for no other reason than that sometimes you just, the story that you're telling is in a certain vein, and this vein is more like a PG movie than the previous ones. But like you said, it's still got it all there. It's just probably a lot. I'm not going to have a young adult version of this novel. I don't need it like I did for Chronicles of the Nephilim. You know,
right,
for those
right.
who could. For those who are more sensitive to the violence and sexuality and stuff like that, the sin that we depicted in that I depicted in Chronicles of the Nephilim, I did a young adult version for people who are more sensitive, and that's okay. But I won't need that with Dragon King because it's a really broad public.
And the now the setting of now let me backtrack and take another run at that question. The Dragon King in China. Obviously, the image of the dragon is much more positive in Chinese culture than it is to us in the West. Was there any discussion between you and Charlie of how to depict that without coming down one way or the other in favor of the Chinese perspective versus the Western perspective of the dragon?
Probably of all the elements in the book, you know, one of my headlines for my ads for the book is East eats West, you know, instead of East meets West, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, our goal was to try to show cultural differences, to appreciate cultural differences, to learn from them, and even if you don't agree with all of them, to slam one or the other all the time, cultural differences. But there are some things, some images, some, you know, fundamental worldview notions that we do remain true to, because in the end, truth is not culturally relative. And so the dragon is one of those that I would say in the story that, you know, we pretty much, as far as I can remember, we pretty much take the Christian notion of the dragon. But what we do different is the Western and the Eastern versions of dragons are very different. You know, the Western mindset is, you know, the big dinosaur looking scaled fire breathing dragon. And it's interesting, the West is more fire oriented, but the East, the Chinese dragon is more of a serpent, literally a serpent. You know, he has little legs, right? And it's more water oriented rather than fire-oriented. So we tried to bring in that element, and of course we don't have any visuals for it, but if we ever get the movie made, it'll be a fascinating different take on what a dragon may look like, you know, and even how big they are or whatever. You know?
Well, it is fascinating, and the idea that Antiochus Epiphanes, who later is the one who creates the abomination that causes desolation when he sacrifices the pig in the temple in Jerusalem, was looking for this ultimate weapon of mass destruction. Can we imply or maybe assume or infer, not imply, infer was the word I meant, that perhaps Antiochus will show up in future books in the Chronicles of the Watchers series?
Yes, that's definitely on the maps. Absolutely, Maccabees and all that kind of stuff. Oh yeah. Now I don't. I'm not sure if what you were saying. I'm not sure what you intended to say, but Antiochus Epiphanes is actually one of the sons of Antiochus the Great.
Oh, okay. All right. I confused him.
Part of the problem is that in those cultures, you know, nobility would carry the same names, and so we can get them confused. And the hero of my story, his name is Antiochus, but he's not the same as those. He's actually – his name is Antiochus the Younger because he is – he's a fictional character that we made up as being one of the – although there is some indications of another son that was born that was, you know, was killed or died, you know, and you know, these kings had all these concubines and they would have all these different children. Right.
Yeah.
So our construct was fictional and that he was one of his bastard sons. But he takes the name Antiochus as well. So that's the difference. But yeah, one of my goals is to deal with the Antiochus Epiphanes. But before that, we're probably going to do a prequel, of Daniel. So
very cool. Well, I should have done a little more Wikipediaing because I see that Antiochus Epiphanes wasn't born until 6 years after the action depicted in The Dragon King. So if I'd followed one more link, I would have been able to save myself that question.
That stuff gets so confusing, all the names. I'm telling you, man. And yeah. I'll have to study it for hours sometimes before I get any of it straight because it's so confusing. You know, the names overlap like you wouldn't believe.
Well, but overlapping the history again from that period of history, 221, 222 BC, thereabouts, and finding that you've got Antiochus the Great ruling in the West, essentially, and this was prior to the rise of the Roman Republic to the height of its power and then followed by the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
And the first king to unify the various states of China. At the same time, that had to be a really exciting discovery. It's like, whoa, I think we found the handle.
No, that's exactly what happened because our first thing was we want to tell the story of China. But then we said, you know what, but we want to bring the West into it. What was going on at this time?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, Antiochus the Great. Oh, that's awesome because I knew a little bit about him. You know, I heard about him because of my reading into the Maccabees and such. And of course, like I said, Antiochus the Great is before that. But in the course of reading up on that stuff, I had heard a little bit about it. And he was an interesting king anyway, the Seleucid Empire. And that's where it was just, you're right. Those serendipitous, or I would call them actually providential connections, you know, the discovery that we had, you know, just continues to blow my mind. The connections that we found to bring spiritual meaning to all this was just amazing.
What evidence do we have? I mean, obviously we've got some because of the origins of some of the words that I think in the book, it was really almost jaw-dropping seeing the connections between some of the very basic words in the Chinese language and what is clearly a biblical origin for those words. How much evidence is there of travel between East and West, the Greeks and the Romans and the Chinese at this period of history?
Yes, yes, yes. You know, there's the reality of most historians is that they usually assume that there, even if we don't have any examples recorded, that there probably was some.
Mm-hmm.
However, what I discovered was there were these oracle bones that had been discovered. And I mentioned this in the story, actually, that, and I think they were actually, the oracle bones were in China, but they showed that Cyrus the Great actually did have some interaction with China. Of course, at that time, it wasn't called China, just so that, you know, but yeah. And so that's where I got that whole idea. It was like, whoa, this can go back and there is a connection going on here. So, and of course, Cyrus the Great is you know the Persian king who came shortly after Daniel, right? So, and he's of course part of prophecies in Daniel as well, and about Israel's return to Israel's return to
Well, to the Holy Land. I mean, Jews returned. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was really fascinating to find that out. And I thought, okay, let's bring that in. So we brought that in as well. So, yeah, there may have been some trading connections of some kind even way back then.
Hmm.
But outside of that, there's no official, you know what I mean? Like, sort of like the official civilization connection, most people chart back to Marco Polo, you know?
Right.
And, you know, because they connect it to trading and the ability to start trading and all that kind of stuff. But obviously, before that time, there was probably, you know, little contacts here and there, but no grand historical connection.
Well,
you know?
And it was probably as much as for anything else, because until that first great emperor of the Chinese, there was no great empire to warrant trade. You just had a number of small independent tribes, really, and crossing all the mountains to deal with those guys, like, it's not worth it.
Exactly.
Call us when you set up the empire. It's fascinating stuff. And again, the historical detail and facts on which the story is based, for me, I found really exciting. But I think people who are just looking for a great story will be entertained as well. And, of course, undergirded by the reality, the biblical reality of the divine counsel and the watchers paradigm, just makes it even more enjoyable and easy to recommend for readers of all ages. So it's well done. High marks for you and for Charlie. And boy, if this can be turned into a film,
we're gonna try.
That would be fantastic. We'd be I don't know that we'd be camping out for tickets. We'd probably try to call in some favors, but we'd be
You know, that's the big thing these days is Chinese money in movies. And so this would be perfect, you know, because it's a respectful story towards the Chinese. They're not bad guys. And, you know, and absolutely. In fact, that's another reason why you read the book so quickly. The book is the shortest book I've written, because we really wanted to write it like you're watching a movie, and we wanted to give that sense of feeling, you know, as you're reading a book, it's like you're watching a movie. So we wrote it that way, you know, we're gonna try to pitch it to different companies maybe in the future, just by giving them the book and saying, hey, you know, check out this story, and maybe you want to adapt it to a film, you know. But it'll be so huge and expensive that, you know, it's very, very difficult to get those
to do it right. Sure, absolutely, yeah.
Unless I become a New York Times bestseller, so I don't know that that's going to happen. So,
we'll help in any way we can. This small effort, hopefully, will push it right onto the bottom of the chart there and get it started. Brian Gadawa and Charlie Wen, co-authors of the new book, The Dragon King, First Emperor of China. It's the first release in the Chronicles of the Watchers series, which is online at, is it chroniclesofthewatchers.com?
Yeah, or you know what? Nowadays, it's just Gadawa.com. They can find everything at Gadawa.com.
Yep, that's the way to do it. I'll put a link in the show notes at vftb.net. This is my third interview today, so my jaw's starting to get a little tired. Brian, we appreciate your time today, especially this late on a Friday. And, brother, we look forward to seeing what comes next.
Thanks a lot.
And if you're not sure how to spell Gadawa, as in Gadawa.com, just check the show notes at vftb.net, and that'll take you right to Brian's website, where you'll find everything you want to know about the Chronicles of the Watchers series, the Chronicles of the Nephilim, his nonfiction works, including his book that compiles all of the footnotes that he put into the Chronicles of the Nephilim series. In other words, all of the scriptural support for the existence of giants in the land in those days. So, and his books on script writing and storytelling, and he's a multimedia diverse threat, and it's all at Gadawa.com. He's got some other things in the works that I'm not at liberty to talk about, but it is exciting to see what he's producing, and it's good to know that there is good, interesting, exciting fiction available out there that is also true to the biblical account of what we know to be true. I mean, obviously he builds on it to create an entertaining story, but the basic theology is sound, and that's key. So, not going to spend much time on the post game commentary here, as it were. This is, of course, Super Bowl Sunday. Just one story note, and that is, New Apostolic Reformation prophet Rick Joyner has said that there was a prophecy by Bob Jones, and this is not Bob Jones of Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, but Bob Jones, who was one of the Kansas City prophets with Rick Joyner, Mike Bickle, and others back in the day, who reportedly said some years ago that when the Carolina Panthers won the Super Bowl, there would be a revival across the land. It's not quite halftime as I record this. Denver is leading 13-7 at this point, but regardless of the final score, I seriously doubt the outcome of the game is going to have an impact on whether or not revival comes to the United States or the world. My personal feeling is not quite as optimistic as most in the New Apostolic Reformation. If you've listened to this program for any length of time, you probably already know that. I don't think historically the evidence indicates that we're in line for a revival. It would be great. And I know Tom Horn doesn't agree with me on this. Tom sees the possibility of revival out there. I just see that the trend of our culture in the West is decaying year by year on a moral basis. So I don't see it happening. I think we're in the midst of the prophesied great falling away, the great apostasy. But I'm also open and, open to being wrong. So we'll see what happens. But regardless, I don't think that the outcome of the football game tonight is going to matter one way or the other. And frankly, I don't really care. I like Peyton Manning, and Carolina is coached by Ron Rivera, who was a linebacker on that 1985 Super Bowl winning team for the Bears. And being born and raised on the north side of Chicago, you know, that connection is good enough for me. So either team wins, I'm happy with it. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, on Wednesday, a program I really hadn't planned on. This kind of came about spur of the moment on Friday. A friend I hadn't seen for 35 years, a fellow that I knew back in my high school days. He was a member of the Maine South High School debate team in the Chicago area while I was debating for McHenry High School. And so we found ourselves spending a number of Saturdays for a couple of years in the same place and doing roughly the same thing. He was also a camp counselor for the Boy Scouts at the Chicago area Boy Scout camp in Western Michigan at the same time I was. So we got to know each other there, went our separate ways. Lo and behold, we find ourselves back in the same part of Missouri. He's opened a new boarding school for young men who need to get their lives back on track, need to get a high school diploma in order to move ahead with their life, whether it's going into the workforce or the military. New Horizons Christian School is the name of the school. Ed was taking a student on a field trip on Friday in the Springfield area. I think they had a couple of things planned, but while he was in the area, he stopped by the Skywatch TV studios. We recorded an interview, and I think you'll find it intriguing, interesting, and a blessing. And I'd like more people to know about what he is doing. So Ed Apida, a first-time guest on A View from the Bunker, coming up Wednesday, February 10th. February 14th, Richard Shaw, L.A. Marzulli's partner in the excellent Watchers series of DVDs, and also the producer and director of the film Torah Codes, End to Darkness. There's some new things coming out of Israel, some of the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox rabbis there, finding some intriguing messages coming from the Torah Codes, slightly different from the Bible Codes because they search only the Hebrew, what we would call the Old Testament, the Torah. Now, bear in mind, we only look for prophecy to be fulfilled that are contained in the Bible. But some of the messages and things that are coming out of these codes and the research being done by these rabbis, in my mind, defies the laws of probability. So we'll find out more about that. And also get a report from Richard, ground zero practically, of that massive natural gas leak in Aliso Canyon, just north of Los Angeles. Richard lives in Porter Ranch, which is not far from there, and it's been tough going there for the last, 5 months now, since October, when that well began to leak. And this coming week, we will have L.A. Marzulli out here in the Ozarks, so hopefully we'll have an opportunity to get with him, and still need to just coordinate schedules with Sheila Zielinski. We've agreed in principle to appear on each other's programs. We just need to find a time when our schedules will allow for that to happen. But at least the next two programs, you know for sure. Next Wednesday, the 10th, Ed Apita, New Horizons Christian School, and next Sunday, the 14th, Richard Shaw talking about the latest in the Torah codes. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, every Sunday at gilberthouse.org, a new one-hour study in the Old Testament and the New Testament. It's intriguing seeing the synchronicity between the studies each week, which isn't planned. It just happens. It seems like every week that we've done this now, and I think we're on our third New Testament study, third or fourth, but it seems every week that there's a reference in the New Testament study to something we had just read in the Old Testament. So two new studies online now at gilberthouse.org. This Tuesday night on Skywatch TV, Josh Peck and Christina Peck. You probably, if you're familiar with this program, you know who Josh Peck is. You probably have heard his interviews here, or you may be familiar with Josh's excellent program, The Sharpening Report, but you may not be familiar with Christina's story. Trust me, it's worth watching. Skywatch TV on the Christian Television Network, Tuesday night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you have satellite TV, that's DirecTV Channel 376, Dish Network Channel 267. You can also watch it online at ctnonline.com, 9:30 p.m. Eastern, 6:30 p.m. Pacific Time, Tuesday night. That would be February the 9th. And we're adding a couple new networks at Skywatch TV. More about that coming up in the week or two ahead, but new programs, new networks coming up the week following. So we'll tell you more about that next week. Give us a like or a review, either Facebook, the View from the Bunker Facebook page, or a review at iTunes or Stitcher or wherever else you download this podcast, and we certainly appreciate that. And we remind you that A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.